real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Glad to have you tuned in to Connecting Faith today. I'm Neil Staben, along with Ted Ross, and you can relate to these words, perhaps. Conflict, hatred, and injustice seem to be the norm rather than the exception in our world. The fractures and fissures run so deep that we're paralyzed by our hopelessness, writing off peace as a far-fetched option for the afterlife.
That's sad but true.
Yeah, think about the ongoing conflicts that seem to rage in our nation. I mean, just St. Louis again.
And, right, most recently that, and Charlottesville earlier this summer.
Yeah, and of course, it goes back to Middle East tensions for years, for centuries. We had a chance, I had a chance to sit down with a Northwestern alum, Jer Schweigert, just recently. He was on campus last week, and he is leader of the Global Immersion Project. And we're going to talk about what it means to be men and women of peace, as God designed it.
Much-needed conversation in this time of conflict.
You know, many of us probably think conflict is inevitable, and I guess it likely is, but how do we actually do peacemaking? We're going to talk about that today here on Connecting Faith. As we address a new book, maybe it's even a new thought for you, Mending the Divides, Creating Love in a Conflicted World. My guest here on Connecting Faith is Jer Schweigert, who is a faith leader, a social innovator, and the co-founding director of a peacemaking training organization called the Global Immersion Project. And he and his family live in Bend, Oregon. He is actually an alum of the University of Northwestern and had an opportunity to connect with him here. He's on campus today. Jer, welcome to Connecting Faith.
It's great to be with you. Thanks, Neil.
So maybe we'll start with the title of the ministry, the organization, the Global Immersion Project. And I was just wondering, you know, is by global, do you mean that, you know, the whole world is your target market? That's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge, yeah. And in light of what's happening in our world right now, it feels like there's quite a lot of job security when it comes to peacemaking. But no, the Global Immersion Project is, it's a peacemaking training organization that's really focused on the U.S. American church. And our hope is to teach U.S. American Christians what it means to be instruments of peace and to do it in a way that is connected to our global village. And so peacemaking is, it's not a fad, it's not a program, it's not an add-on to our faith. It's core to what it means to be a follower of Jesus. And so we're really focused on helping the American church understand what it means to actually embody a theology of peace and peacemaking such that we become the people who join God in the work of restoration wherever we find ourselves, whether that's in our homes, our neighborhoods, our cities, or our larger world.
Well, you talked about the theology of peace. I mean, the Bible obviously talks about that. Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, famous words, blessed are the peacemakers, but you look around, whether it's, you know, Charlottesville or Baltimore, Ferguson, Louisiana, wherever. I mean, it seems like hatred and conflict have the upper hand. I mean, is it realistic to think that peacemaking could actually happen, take
place?
Yeah,
that's good. That's a great question. I mean, our perspective on this is that, first and foremost, that God waged a decisive peace in Jesus, and it worked. And it meant that people who weren't going to make it are going to make it now. And that the peace that God waged in Jesus wasn't just about the restoration of the human soul. It was about the restoration of identity. It was about the restoration of interpersonal relationships, of broken systems, of the relationship between humanity and creation. If that's true, then the adventure that we've been saved into is to actually join God in the work of restoration. And so is it possible? We have to believe that it's possible if it's the work that we've been commissioned into. But you know, one of the questions that we always get is, well, if the peace that God waged in Jesus is so decisive, why do things like Charlottesville happen? Barcelona, that happened recently. Why do these things keep happening? And from our perspective, part of the reason that they keep happening is because the enemy prowls like an angry lion right now, knows that he's defeated, and Christians in our world have kind of abdicated our vocation as makers of peace in the world. And so it seems as though we spend more time sitting around making sure that there's a kind of a base level of morality and that, you know, we're volunteering here and there rather than actually moving toward the points of pain and joining God in what God is doing here, near and far. And so, we have to believe that restoration is possible. Ultimately, a big, huge restoration is coming, but we follow a Jesus who says, behold, I am making all things new. You know, a Jesus who didn't say, behold, I made or I will make. I am making all things new. And so The adventure for us as followers of Jesus is to join Jesus in the work of peace and restoration here and now.
You mentioned the systemic issues. I guess is it enough to restore individual relationships, or does that address systemic issues? Because it seems like we're facing big obstacles. If it's just one-on-one, one at a time, it feels like that will take a long time.
Absolutely, yeah. And for me to be a peacemaker, the change has to start with me. And that's the stuff of, like, the power of the gospel needs to continue to transform me into someone who thinks, sounds, and acts like Jesus. And so, you're absolutely right. I think we need to start with the transformation of human souls. Understanding that human souls are the creators and the perpetuators of systems that are either just or unjust. And at the same time, there are systems that are in play in our country that from the outset have been unjust systems that have benefited people who look like me at the cost of people who don't look like me. And so I think it needs to be a both and in terms of our pastors and faith leaders focusing on the transformation of the human soul and using their voice, their platform, and their privilege to ensure that systems that are broken are either renovated or replaced in our country in particular.
How do we typically respond to some of these deep-seated fractures and the anger and hatred? I mean, as Christians, it seems like we probably, as you say, we've kind of abdicated. So is that what we've been doing?
Yeah, it feels to me that there's been a disassociation, in speaking specifically of white Christianity, there's been a disassociation of some of these issues. It's almost as though we don't need to show up to it. And so a story, a friend of mine who's been a pastor in Oakland, his name's Ben McBride. His moment around this question was when he was in his church in the midst of a violent uprising in the streets, violent, like gun violence and so on and so forth happening in their streets. And he went, it had just happened outside the doors of his church on a Saturday evening. On Sunday morning, they all filtered into their church. And the most that they could do was extend their hand to the east where this violence had happened and pray that God would do something about it. And that was the moment for Ben where he just realized, is this the best we can do as followers of Jesus, is to extend our hands and pray, or is there something about embodied faith that we need to learn something about? Do we need to actually move from admiring Jesus to following Jesus? And I wonder if we haven't spent too much time admiring Jesus without actually following him into the streets or into broken relationships or into broken systems equipped with tools to transform. And so the work of Global Immersion is to lay down a theological foundation for American Christians to consider that is a bit more expansive than God came here and died to save my soul and I get to go to heaven if I'm moral and nice enough, to God has actually saved us into an adventure, put us into a mission of restoration, and that following Jesus actually looks like I put skin in the game here. And so Global Immersion is laying down a theological foundation, but then also attaching practices to help people begin to understand, okay, now how do I do that? How do I go from ignoring pain and conflict or injustice or running away from it, or even running to it to win, to moving toward it to transform?
We'll talk in the moments ahead about some of the practical ways what does that look like, actually moving toward, as the book title suggests, Mending the Divides, Creative Love in a Conflicted World. Jerry Schweigert is my guest today. But Jerry, you spent some time in Pakistan, and so tell a little bit about your backstory and how this became really personal and passion for you.
Yeah, Pakistan was the conversion moment for me. And I grew up in a Christian home. I came to Northwestern. I had a strong faith, but I think I would probably indict myself into the space of a Jesus admirer rather than a Jesus follower. I'm not sure I knew how to do that in ways that transformed things. And so I remember it was 2005. I went to my coffee shop in the San Francisco Bay Area and opened the newspaper and saw the headline article was that a 7.2 earthquake had just ravaged northern Pakistan. 80,000 people were dead. 3 million people were homeless in the Himalayas, and winter was coming. Now, what was unique about that moment is at that time, I probably couldn't have pointed Pakistan out on a globe to you. I had no Muslim friends. I was in no way connected to the pain of that particular group of people. But like so often happens, something when God moves, something shattered inside of me in a way that was unfamiliar. And so so I called two mentors. One mentor said, "It sounds like God's up to something in your life. I think I might have a connection for you to get to Pakistan." The second mentor said, "If you can find a connection in Pakistan, I'll fund your trip." And so about 3.5 weeks later, I had an expedited Pakistani visa in my passport, and I found myself on a plane to Islamabad, Pakistan. Now, keep in mind, this is 2005, 4 years removed from 9/11. Pakistan is enemy territory and public enemy, number one, in our estimation. Osama bin Laden was thought to be in Pakistan in a place called the Tora Bora Caves. Tora Bora Caves were in the tribal villages of northern Pakistan where the epicenter of the earthquake was. And so all I knew is that I would be landing in Pakistan and somehow finding my way to the epicenter of this earthquake, most likely in the neighborhood of Osama bin Laden. So I land. I take a car to the very north of Pakistan. They put me on a UN helicopter. I fly to the top of the Himalayas. I got off the helicopter. A Pakistani general named Mumtaz met me, saw that I had my journal in my hand, and he said, "How long are you here?" And I said, "I'm here for about 4 weeks." And he said, "Your job is going to be the communications liaison between the tribal villages of northern Pakistan, the Pakistani military, and the United Nations." And so what was unique about that is that at that moment, I was a 25-year-old white kid from Minnesota who had zero training or preparation for this moment. All I had was some availability and a notebook in my hand. And so for the next 4 weeks, I listened to 156 sets of village elders talk to us about what happened when the earth shook and how many people they lost and how many buildings they lost and what they thought they needed to make it through the winter. And then the last set of village elders that came in at gunpoint, and that was different. And so this was my conversion moment. So in walks this group of village elders, and they have their machine guns up, and now all of my friends bring their machine guns up. And so now it's very hot. It's tense. The general and I are sitting at the fire where we would hold council with these village elders. So at gunpoint, this new set of village elders comes and sits down and has a four-hour screaming match through which I understand that these two villages, the one that I was staying in and the one that just entered in, had been in civil war for 30 years. And the village that just entered in realized that if they were going to make it through the winter, somehow they were going to have to broker peace with their enemy because that's the only way their enemy was going to allow supplies to get to them. And so at the end of the conversation, the general looks at me and he says, "I need you to draft a peace treaty," which again, with all of my international diplomacy and training, I took out my pen and I began to write down the agreements that I heard were being made. And everybody signed, and as they walked away, that's when the gospel went HD for me. You know, that's the moment when I realized that in Jesus, God had waged a decisive peace, and literally people who weren't going to make it were going to make it now. The gospel went so much bigger than personal salvation in that moment. But what's more, I realized that I just got to be a part of that. That I didn't, like, God didn't snap God's fingers and there was peace between these two villages. Granted, they had a lot of work to do after the peace treaty, but like God actually involved me in the work of restoration in that moment. And so if it's true that God waged a decisive peace in Jesus and it worked, it's equally true that that faithfulness to Jesus means a participation in that. It's the life of peacemaking. And so quite literally, central to what it means to follow Jesus means that we enter the divides and we get creative and love in that space.
Powerful story. There's more to come as we continue our conversation with Jer Swigert. Jer is co-founder of the Global Immersion Project. It's a peacemaking training organization that forms, equips, and mobilizes individuals and communities to enter any kind of conflict to heal rather than to win. And he's written a new book called Mending the Divides, Creative Love in a Conflicted World. We're going to come back and talk about how do we really connect to the pain of people. And he mentioned the term brokering peace. Is that really what we're talking about? We'll find out more in moments ahead here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we were spending some time today with Jer Schweigert. Jer has written a new book called Mending the Divides, Creative Love in a Conflicted World. You know, conflict, hatred, injustice, those words seem to be kind of the norm today. Well, Jer is co-founder of the Global Immersion Project. It's a peacemaking training organization, and he and his family live in Bend, Oregon. And this is, he has been sharing his experience in Pakistan, and you use the term broker peace. Is that really what we're talking about? Is it just getting, you know, opposite sides together and, you know, kind of mediating agreements? Is that really what it is?
Yeah, the image that we use when we talk about restoration is, it's an ancient Japanese pottery called kintsugi, and the concept of kintsugi art is you have a vessel, let's take a bowl that has been broken, and then the kintsugi artist puts that bowl back together, but doesn't put the bowl back together in a way that tries to hide the cracks. Rather, the kintsugi artist heals the cracks with solid gold. And so what you have in the finished product of a kintsugi artifact is actually an artifact that is now stronger and more beautiful than before it was broken, where the scars are the golden scars are not a reminder of the break as much as they're a reminder of the restoration. And so we understand God is the great kintsugi artist, that from the moment we reach for the fruit of power in the garden, and all of shalom was shattered, God has been 100% committed to the restoration of all things. This is then what was accomplished, as we read in Colossians 1, 15 through 20. This is what was accomplished through the blood of Jesus, right? And so the restoration of all things is what we get to participate in. So no, it's not, being a part of peacemaking in the way of Jesus is not about brokering compromises, and it's not about legislating peace agreements and so on and so forth. It's about broken relationships becoming restored such that they're stronger and more beautiful than before they were broken. And that plays out interpersonally. That plays out systemically between, in our country today, the divides between the black and the white community. It's not just about legislation, obviously. I mean, Dr. King made it all the way to Washington, D.C. We had legislation, but it didn't change the reality in the streets because the human soul, the content of the human soul. So there's work to be done yet between the black and the white community such that we become one. The kintsugi image becomes the reality of our relationship. Take something like Israel-Palestine, where again, you have two people groups whose the relationship between them is horribly severed. You can't broker, you can't negotiate peace because peace is a relational endeavor. And so we actually enter into these scenarios and we're focusing in on the human transformation that actually begins to cause people to turn toward one another and recognize that we need one another, that we're all image bearers of God, and that we actually have a mutually beneficial future to co-create together.
You know, the phrase enter in, it sounds like a lot of work, probably a lot of discomfort before you actually get to the healing, which I think as you talk about, it's not so much winning as it is healing. But talk about that entering in process and maybe, you know, connect to the pain of the end.
Yeah, that's right. The four practices of everyday peacemaking that we talk about in Mending the Divides are see, immerse, contend, and restore. So these are the four practices that we're teaching and training and actually raising people's capacity for around the country. See, immerse, contend, and restore. To see is to actually acknowledge the humanity and the dignity and the image of God in your other, in your enemy. The immerse is to actually step off the road of comfort and into reality. And, you know, rather than see, immerse, contend, and restore, we have a habit of noticing, diagnosing, solving, and walking away, I think, much to the chagrin of the marginalized and the oppressed. Oftentimes when we notice, diagnose, solve, and walk away, we've actually left more problems than before we noticed. To see actually causes us to immerse, to actually see in more vivid detail. And so the immerse practice, especially for American Christians, is the hardest practice to get our heads around. We can become people who from a distance learn how to see. We're remarkably innovative, even in our kingdom work. We're remarkably innovative, and we want to go from see to content. the immerse piece is the hard one because it's inconvenient, it's inefficient, it takes time. It means, if you think about the story of the Good Samaritan, it means that you get blood on your shoes. You get the muck of humanity under your fingernails. It means that you have to listen longer than feels comfortable. You have to show up as a learner for a long time. And from our perspective, when you look at, this is obviously, theologically speaking, this is the practice of incarnation. When God put on flesh in Jesus, Jesus was in the neighborhood for 30 years before he did anything. So if when God showed up, even with the sense of divine urgency with which God showed up and still hung out in the neighborhood for 30 years before he did anything, maybe we can learn something from his patience in incarnation to actually engage this practice of immerse. And so I have a friend in Oakland. His name's Nate. He's a white leader who lives in the urban center, and he leads an organization called the Oakland Leadership Center. He's a part of a mentoring program for at-risk youth in the urban center. His commitment was to go to every neighborhood council, to go to every meeting he could possibly go to, and sit in the back of the room and do nothing but listen. Now, like Nate, we're both recovering alpha males, and when we walk into rooms, especially as faith leaders, as white faith leaders who are taller than 6 foot, who are articulate and charismatic, when we walk into a room, we fill the space with our voice, with our presence, with our solutions. He walked into the room for 6 years. He sat in the back of the room and he listened. That was his immersion practice. And it was after 6 years that the black leaders on the council looked at him and said, "You've been here long enough and you've been lending your ear for 6 years. Now it's time for you to start lending your voice and your creativity." And as Nate and I processed that through, I'll never forget, Nate said, "Yeah, you know, 6 years seems about right." Like, to immerse as a learner, because it's not until you've immersed that you actually understand what it means to contend. And then the great surprise is that the contending is not a hero-based doing for someone. Contending is a participation with God and with the marginalized, or with your other, or with your enemy, in beginning to actually co-create a restored future. So you can't contend until you've first immersed.
It feels like a lot of pain and heartache and difficulty could happen in that immersion waiting process, though.
Absolutely. And I think so take my story in Pakistan. My immersion into Pakistan, yes, it was the earth that shook, but it was my world that needed to be shaken. And so the immersion, like, I found myself on the observation table in the midst of the immersion. And so the pain of immersion is usually recognizing things like my privilege. It's recognizing the ways in which I have contributed to the pain of my other, of my enemy, of the marginalizer. So it's a very uncomfortable experience to immerse. Yet is transformation itself not uncomfortable? And I wonder if we've actually trained ourselves into believing that discomfort actually signals that something wrong is happening, when in fact discomfort could actually be a signal that something very right is happening for us, that when we're uncomfortable, that's where the Spirit of God is actually at work in our lives.
Jerry Swigert's my guest today. We're talking about mending the divides, creative love in a conflicted world. Jerry is a faith leader, social innovator, and co-founding director of a peacemaking training organization called the Global Immersion Project. We're going to talk more with Jerry in just a moment. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We live in a world today where conflict, hatred, and injustice seems to be the norm. And yet, we know that Jesus called us to be peacemakers. How do we get the two together? How do we maybe get around that? The subtitle of Jerry Swigert's new book is called Creative Love in a Conflicted World. I want to find out what creative love looks like. What does that mean? Jerry's co-founding director of a peacemaking training organization called the Global Immersion Project. Jer, mending the divides, creative love in a conflicted world. What's creative here that we maybe have missed before?
Yeah, the subtitle itself comes out of Matthew 5:38-42. And if you remember, that's the passage where Jesus says, if someone slaps you, turn the other cheek. If someone sues you, give them everything. If someone asks you to walk a mile, walk with them too. In that moment, Jesus is actually saying, when power is abused and you're the victim, don't get even. Get creative in love. You know, there's I'm a part of a long history of a deep tradition of nonviolent direct action, and where where the use of power and violence is not working, but the use of creative nonviolence, of powerlessness, is actually the greatest power in the world. And I think we see that most notably on the cross, where rather than ushering or inaugurating his kingdom on a white stallion with a sword, Jesus actually allowed himself to be placed on the cross of a militarized empire. An act of powerlessness, peaceful nonviolence, is actually the thing that ushered in the restoration of all things. And so it's in the midst of conflict, it's in the midst of injustice that there aren't necessarily universal things that we can do to either alleviate it or to reconcile the conflict. It's in the midst of it that creativity, there's a divine imagination that we've been given. And if God is 100% committed to restoration, it's the Spirit that actually awakens our imaginations to how we can actually enter into conflict interpersonally, injustice locally, conflict internationally, with an imagination, with some experimentation, with initiatives, creating initiatives that begin to build the capacity of the next generation, or begin to disarm the violent community, begin to disarm them by revealing to them our own humanity, and so on and so forth. And so, rather than, and I think protest movements are important, and so on and so forth. But I think there are initiatives that we can engage in that are subversive, that are creative, that are cross-shaped, that actually begin to change the game from the ground up.
I'm wondering, I mean, you spent a few weeks in Pakistan. You've worked in the San Francisco Bay Area, Oakland. You traveled the world. Are the divisions and anger, maybe in our country, on the same level as, say, Israel, Palestine, Rwanda? I mean, do they all kind of come down to the same thing? And so are the principles universal?
Yeah, that's good. I mean, in Bend, which is my neighborhood of practice right now, we're a city of 100,000 folks. There are 12,000 migrants in my community, and 6,500 of them are undocumented. And so in the midst of what's happening in our country right now, we've got 6,500 people who are terrified. 3,500 of them are DACA students. They're covered right now under a provisional status of documentation. And these people are terrified. They're destabilized. And so what we're hearing nationally and internationally are these things are happening in our own neighborhoods. Immigration isn't happening somewhere else. The black-white race divide is not happening somewhere. It's actually happening in our neighborhood. What's happening in Israel-Palestine, it's, you take a look at what's happening between Christians, Jews, and Muslims in our own country. I was just at Dar al-Farouk Mosque here in the Twin Cities, which is the mosque that was just bombed. And you see that hatred and that tension actually embodied, and it's a terrifying thing. I would say that the parallels between what's happening in a place like Israel-Palestine and what's happening between the black and the white community here in the United States is breathtakingly similar. It is so remarkably similar when you're talking about a power structure and system that has actually been put in place at the cost of another people group. And the perpetuation of that system actually requires the ongoing indifference of the power, the people in the dominant culture, and the silence of the oppressed people. And so that's very similar to what we have going on here. Dr. King, when we're talking about Charlottesville and something like this, Dr. King looked at what we just saw in Charlottesville, and he didn't look at that act of, in my opinion, cowardice, and he didn't say, this is the most dangerous danger there is. These people carrying torches and screaming chants about no one being replacing us, and so on and so forth. He's not looking at the Klan as the most dangerous threat. He's looking at the apathetic, indifferent white church as the greatest threat, because we just continue to stand by and do nothing. And so yeah, I think what I'm seeing globally, there are so many things that are similar. In Israel-Palestine, it's on another level in terms of the racism and the hatred that you see in the streets. But then you come back here and you see something like Charlottesville, and you're like, actually, I don't know how different it really is. I think the Band-Aid is coming off, and some of the true colors of America are showing now in some breathtaking ways.
One of the phrases I saw just looking over your material is about making peacemaking a vocation. Interesting. We probably don't look at that as it feels that, well, this is sort of an add-on that I do maybe once in a while.
Yeah, so. Good. The vocation, of course, we're not talking about you know, people like a how you make your living. We're talking about how you spend your life. And you know, Christian discipleship is not something that happens when we want to. It's not something that happens on a Sunday or on a Wednesday or whenever we're convening with other people who claim to follow Jesus. Christian discipleship is an everyday reality. And it doesn't matter, like in my home, that's where the rubber meets the road when it comes to peacemaking. In my relationship with my wife, that's where the rubber meets the road. And I have no credibility as a peacemaker in the streets if I have no peace, if there's no peace between my wife and I. You know, in my neighborhood, there are things happening in my neighborhood, my direct neighborhood that I just mentioned, especially with the migrant community, that I don't get to like maybe show up to that or like volunteer. Like that's in my neighborhood. And so following Jesus means I move in the direction of those who are terrified and in this case, marginalized. And so like this is what we're trying to do with the Global Immersion Project is not add on to your faith. We're actually trying to redefine our faith as a great participation with God in God's mission of restoration. And if it's an all life, if it's the way that you spend your life, like a you know the way that I would paraphrase Matthew 5:9 is Jesus saying, "Blessed are the men and women who spend their lives waging peace." Who spend their lives. That's the stuff of vocation. That's how I show up to work. That's how I show up in my commute. That's how I show up as I volunteer. That's how I show up in my neighborhood. It's a vocation that we embody.
And I'm sure you mentioned it's in the home. I mean, you have young children. I mean, all of us, I think, we need to model this for our families, right? It has to start at home. Are there some things that we could do to really help enforce or reinforce that with our kids?
Yeah, the most important peacemakers that I'm working on forming are my three kids. And I want them, to grow up with an expansive theology about a pro-human God who, when we look at Jesus, we discover a cross-wearing, enemy-loving, others-embracing God, and a God who could not hold himself back from restoring the severed relationships between us and him. You know, I want their understanding of God to not be exclusive. I want it to be inclusive, and so inclusive was it that God came and spent his life on our behalf. You know, so for me, it's in the way that I disciple my kids, and which, by the way, it means that for me, I can't outsource the spiritual formation of my kids to a church, to Bible camp, I have to take responsibility for discipling my kids. And that involves the music that we listen to. It involves the books that we read. It involves the conversations that we have. My 9-year-old daughter, I probably err on the side of exposing her too much to the pain in the world. But what it's growing in her in terms of her heart of compassion and empathy is breathtaking. The way that she's already showing up as a little wager of peace in the context of her school is the stuff that we get feedback on, you know. And so, absolutely, I could spend my life working with churches around the country, raising their capacity for the work of everyday peacemaking, and if my kids, if they don't experience me living this with them, inviting them into it, discipling them into it. You know, I don't know. My three kids getting this is the most important thing on the planet to me, yeah. You know? And so, and Jackie and I are so committed to that being true.
You know, you talked about birthing a heart of compassion. I'm thinking that that's what God wants for all of us. Maybe just paint a little picture of that for, you know, someone listening and kind of, you know, well, good for you, Jer. I'm not quite ready to jump into the connect to the pain, maybe just paint a picture what that heart of compassion could really do in terms of our own spiritual walk and into the lives of those that we come in contact with.
I'll position that in the story of the Good Samaritan, where you have the religious elite who see the voiceless victim on the road. They notice this person, but they are not moved with compassion. And actually, for the religious elite, this is interesting. It's their misunderstanding of faithfulness that actually causes them to remain distant from the person who is in need, right? It's the Samaritan, you know, the Samaritan is the only one in the story who actually saw the humanity, dignity, and image of God in the voiceless victim. And what the Samaritan saw generated compassion, and then compassion became the precursor for responsibility. And so compassion is not just this thing that like, oh, I feel sorry that that happens. Compassion is a fuel that actually moves us into merciful action. And so what you see in the story is then you have the Samaritan who begins to repurpose the things that he already has to begin to contend for the flourishing of this voiceless victim. And so I'm not interested anymore in people just being moved by whether it's a broken relationship or moved by what they're reading. Like people who are just simply moved by what happened in Charlottesville, I want them to learn how to leverage that like ache and let that begin to grow into compassion. And once that happens, all of a sudden they're going to find themselves in the back of the rooms like my friend Nate going, I have to learn more about this because my faith actually, it drives me. Like I have my faith intersects with this in a way that I have to show up and I have to put my skin in the game. And so compassion, less something that is an emotion and more a fuel, something that actually informs the substance of our lives.
Hope that as you've been listening, you've been getting challenged and fueled during our conversation with Jerry Schweiger, talking Mending the Divides, Creative Love in a Conflicted World, new book out from University Press. Jared, say a word about what happens at the Global Immersion Project. You've got learning labs, intensives. Say a bit more about what happens and where people can get connected.
Yeah, the work itself is really, as I said, it's a training initiative. And so everything that we do is designed to raise the capacity of people of faith for a life of faith, and that life of faith looking like peacemaking. And so we do, you know, I travel all around the country speaking and training. We do workshops and retreats and we do online courses. We host a series of webinars that really help people get in touch with some of the most significant points of pain around our world, where we're actually calling upon the experts and the practitioners who are embedded in those conflicts to give us perspective and to do some teaching and training with us. And so we're all about resourcing people's transformation into this way of life. The signature offering of Global Immersion is a learning lab, and our philosophy is if you want to learn about peace, go to conflict because it's the best classroom in the world. And if you want to learn about peacemaking, go learn from the peacemakers embedded in those conflicts because they're the best teachers in the world. And so the two locations for our learning labs are in the borderlands between San Diego and Tijuana, with a focus on immigration, refugees, and asylum seekers, and in Israel-Palestine with a focus on that particular conflict, but also this unique relationship between the monotheistics, Christians, Jews, and Muslims. And so in both spaces, we do some online training to get us ready for what we're about to experience. And then in both labs, we immerse into the center of the pain. And in Israel-Palestine, we spend 50% of our time in Israel, 50% of our time in the Palestinian territories. We're learning from Jews, Christians, and Muslims. 90% of the people we're learning from are some of the best peacemakers on the planet. And then 10% are people who dwell on a bit of an ideological extreme. For us, the work of peacemaking means that we're able to actually begin building relationships with people with whom we disagree. And so that's very important in the work of the of our learning lab as well. And then we do 10 months of integrative coaching on the flip side of the trip itself. This is not a mission trip. We say that mission begins once you return. Once you get home, that's where mission begins. And so our organization does 10 months of integrative coaching with faith leaders all around the country who have experienced these to now begin to integrate their learning into practice. Number one is everyday peacemaking practitioners and as movemental leaders. How do you now take this and begin to inform and impact the culture of your church in light of what you experienced with us?
What's the web address when people find out more?
Globalimmerse.org. You can learn more about us there, and feel free to locate me there and reach out.
Globalimmerse.org, and then look for the new book as well, Mending the Divides, Creative Love in a Conflicted World. Jerry Schweiger, faith leader, social innovator, co-founding director of the Global Immersion Project, with us today here on Connecting Faith. Jerry, thank you so much for your sharing your passion with us and the challenge before us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Neil.
Jared's been on the campus at the University of Northwestern for a couple days, so we had the opportunity to talk with him in studio. In just a moment here on Connecting Faith, we're going to hear from someone who was on campus a couple years ago and some powerful things to say, too, about how we live out our faith and see the world through Jesus' eyes. Just ahead, we'll talk with Eugene Cho, founder of One Day's Wages.